KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Over time, the star of the show became the dominant power. And I figured out very early that I was going to be a lot safer with an ensemble drama. Because if somebody really turned out to be a jerk, you could sit him down.
Stephen Bochco, the writer-producer behind record-breaking Emmy winners Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and NYPD Blue, dealt with more than a few jerks in his long career. And he isn't afraid to tell those tales in his memoir, Truth is a Total Defense. For Memorial Day weekend, we're revisiting our conversation with Bochco. He recounts battles big and small, including a legal brawl with Rupert Murdoch, and the firing of an actor with very particular bathroom habits. But first on the News Banter, Colbert and Maddow romp in the Trump era. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we have seen quite the reversal of fortune lately in terms of a couple of key parts of the TV landscape. And this is seemingly due to the political environment in this country with the constant news about Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the late night television landscape, we just got word that Stephen Colbert has beaten Jimmy Fallon at The Tonight Show in total viewers for the 2016-2017 season, which is a pretty remarkable reversal of fortune considering, you know, it wasn't long ago that people were talking about Colbert getting canceled because he just wasn't clicking and wasn't working. And this election has completely reinvigorated him.
Yeah, he is now the darling of CBS and was a major part of the upfront presentation to advertisers recently. So that was reversal number one. And meanwhile, in the news space, possibly, maybe arguably an even more amazing reversal.
Right. If you look at the ratings for this past week, we saw for the first time in 17 years, MSNBC not only beat Fox News and CNN, but Fox News had fallen to number three overall. This is a network that for the better part of 15 years has consistently been number one in cable news, and not just number one by a long shot. But what's happening now is these news breaks about Donald Trump and all of his personal and political troubles are galvanizing the MSNBC audience, and they are flocking there to personalities like Rachel Maddow and others that are giving them their fix. And if you look at Fox News, they're not talking about Donald Trump's problems.
Yeah, it's been almost bizarre. You can see, watch a lot on the internet where people are tweeting about what Fox is doing instead of covering what is major breaking news on other channels. Now, this isn't necessarily a static picture, of course, and we do see some movement even, you know, as Trump news breaks, MSNBC surges, but so far Trump news breaks almost constantly. And then when there's global news, such as the tragedy in Manchester, CNN surges. But we know that there is a potential toll on Fox News that may last because so much has happened in terms of the, you know, starting with the top, they dismissed Roger Ailes. We haven't talked about it in banter yet, but he not only was dismissed for the alleged sexual harassment conduct that Fox had settled lawsuits for millions of dollars to resolve, but, you know, then he subsequently passed away. So he was gone in every sense of the word. And then O'Reilly disappeared. Bill O'Reilly, again, sexual harassment allegations. There is litigation. Greta Van Susteren has gone to MSNBC. Megyn Kelly has gone to NBC. It's a total transformation in the Fox News lineup. And I don't know that the personalities that replaced, certainly O'Reilly, who was dominant, you know, I don't know that Tucker Carlson or anybody else commands the same following.
It's a fascinating business question because clearly the Murdoch family, James and Lachlan, who are now running the parent 21st Century Fox, have decided that Fox News needed a change and needed to be cleaned up. And, you know, they have been aggressive in first ousting Roger Ailes and then, you know, dealing with some of these other issues there. And the question is, are they able to keep the ratings up when they make all these changes and maintain what is a $20 to $30 billion business that Roger Ailes built for them. And at least for now, they've got some real issues because this audience is not there in the way that the audience is there on MSNBC right now to follow all the Trump stuff. And a lot of people have said that, you know, Roger Ailes, if he were still there, he would have figured out a way to galvanize that Fox News audience and keep them interested in Fox News, you know, despite the fact that the Trump, you know, agenda is not something that Fox News typically would rail against. And they had found their bread and butter railing against a lot of the Clinton first and then Obama administration stuff. But it'll be very interesting to see going forward how if Fox News pivots or how they deal with this audience erosion.
In a microcosm, you sort of have this dilemma encapsulated by what's been going on with the last of the old guard stars, which is Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity, who obviously I think feels so isolated by all that has happened, had decided to pursue a story about the murder of Seth Rich, this Democratic National Committee staffer. This is a conspiracy theory that this guy, this poor victim of this murder, whose parents are grieving, had really been the source of WikiLeaks leaks from the Clinton campaign. There is nothing in evidence, as has been pointed out universally, to support that. And Fox News had actually retracted an article suggesting that this conspiracy theory might be real. And in the wake of that, Sean Hannity had to do this kind of strange retreat where he said he wasn't pursuing it out of respect for the parents, which would seem to be entirely new, but for now he's not pursuing it. So he seemed to be trying to balance himself in some ways, winking at his audience that he's keeping up this pursuit of this conspiracy theory and somehow at the same time appeasing maybe his bosses, maybe lawyers had conversation with him, but he put himself in a strange position and I don't know how long that remains tenable.
Yeah, and then he went on a two-day vacation, which, as we know from the Bill O'Reilly situation, it's the dreaded Fox News vacation from which you never return. Although I will say that Fox News has, in this case, said that Hannity will be back. I don't believe Hannity will be on Fox News in a year. I just don't believe that.
I think a shorter timeline on it.
Yeah, he is such a product of the Roger Ailes Fox News. Ailes found him in an Atlanta station and made him a star, and he's so loyal to that crew and everything that Fox News stood for. I just don't see him staying.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Early episodes of the groundbreaking series Hill Street Blues, including the 1981 pilot, opened with Sergeant Phil Esterhaus, played by Michael Conrad, holding a morning briefing for a bunch of rowdy Hill Street cops.
Said officers are hereby warned to immediately surrender such weapons to the custody of their sergeant or face disciplinary action. Said weapons inspection starts now. All right, that's it. Let's roll. Hey, let's be careful out here.
Unlike the procedurals of the time, Hill Street Blues featured interlocking storylines that unfolded over multiple episodes. While not an instant ratings hit, Hill Street Blues helped reverse the fortunes of NBC, then in last place among the major networks, and became part of the network's formidable Thursday night must-see TV lineup. In its first year, the series received an historic 21 Emmy nominations and won 8. Our guest today, Hill Street Blues co-creator Stephen Bochco, picked up 2 of those for outstanding drama and outstanding writing for that pilot episode. Following 5 seasons on Hill Street Blues, Bochco produced dozens of shows, including L.A. Law, Doogie Howser, M.D., and NYPD Blue. Bochco recounts his decades in television in a new memoir called Truth is a Total Defense. I recently sat down with him in his office in Santa Monica. I got to assume that today Hill Street would be a cable show.
Probably, but there was nothing in it even then. I mean, broadcast standards used to whoop and holler about not so much language because we kind of invented our own language.
Right.
Most of their issues had to do with political correctness. They were always concerned that, you know, we had too many black criminals or Hispanic criminals. And you know, there wasn't a balance. And you know, my argument was, guys, we're in a ghetto. But, you know, we would make certain accommodations. But as off the wall as some of those characters were, there really wasn't anything we were doing that would today consign us to cable.
But would you want to do it, cable, so you wouldn't have to worry about that
stuff? If we had had the opportunity to do that show at that time for cable, I think it would have been a little more out there in terms of language and stuff like that. You know, NYPD Blue was, for me, the natural consequence of Hill Street. And that really caused a lot of angst, you know, at the network level.
I think the first episode you saw at Andy Sipowicz's bare butt.
Well, yeah, because he got shot.
When he was with a prostitute,
yeah,
if I'm remembering
this
right.
Yeah, with a prostitute in a cheap hotel room or whatever it was. And she had been set up by, you know, a gangster to get him there. And the gangster came in and shot him in the ass.
Now, throughout the book, you talk about actors be crazy, kind of like a lot of crazy actors that you, and it starts early on. You talk about Keel Martin played one of the cops. He had a drug problem you allude to in the book.
Well, he was an alcoholic. He was a drug addict. He was a mess.
And at one point you recount that you told him, if you don't stop this, I will make sure you never work again.
Yeah.
Now that is the ultimate Hollywood cliche, you know, you'll never work again. Do you think you could have actually blacklisted this guy?
Oh, I never would have. I was trying to get his attention.
Right.
You know, and I said to him, first I'm going to sit you down. And I said, I will make you the highest paid extra in television.
In other words, your role will vanish.
Yeah, essentially. And that I could have done. And I meant it when I said it, because he had become horrendously disruptive in the environment. But what I said to him was, I don't think you have the balls to do it.
To get sober.
And I said, I want you in rehab by the end of business today. And I had done all the research. I had just set it up so that he could just go there and check in. I said, this is not negotiable. Either you're in there by the end of business today, or I'll do everything in my power to, you know, get you blackballed. And he said, but I owe money and I have to this. I mean, every excuse imaginable. And I said, we'll pay your bills for you, which we did. Make a long story short, he actually went into rehab that night, and he came out 14 days later, and he never had another drink.
Wow.
It was a miracle.
So among others that you talk about, I mean, there's a lot about David Caruso and what a miserable, unhappy, terrible guy he was on NYPD Blue. However, the one that maybe actually caught my attention a little more was this Daniel Benzali story on Murder One. Here is this guy who, as you point out in your book, he's not what you would think of as a leading man. He's a big, hulking,
bald-headed, unattractive man, but a wonderful actor. Wonderful actor who you would have thought he'd have been so grateful to have this kind of a break, to be the star of a well-publicized and well-regarded television series, and he just shot himself in the foot.
Well, the way he shot himself in the foot, the story as you tell it, he's late every single day. You're like, why are you late every day? And he has this, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. He lives in Malibu. He has to have his coffee. He then needs to
have his bowel movement.
Sit on the toilet, yes. And by the time he gets there, he's held everybody up for an hour, which is obviously money, serious money in TV with the clock running and everybody sitting there. And you come up with like 15, how about you have the coffee here? No, I can't use the toilet here. How about you get an apartment near the thing? And no matter, this guy, you actually fired him.
I did.
Because he would not alter this coffee in the morning in my house in Malibu, toilet in my house in Malibu.
Yeah. This all came up. We were probably three quarters of the way through the season. So when it became clear to me that he simply wasn't going to cooperate and try to help us solve this problem, I said, okay. Don't worry about it. And, you know, we had like four more episodes to make or something. We did. And then I let him go.
So having said all of that, was Caruso actually the worst?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody else was an amateur compared to David. He was abusive on the set, argued about everything. He would always say, you know, who wrote this crap? And these were arguably the best written television scripts I'd ever been fortunate enough David Milch. Participate in. And David was at the absolute top of his game, David Milch. But also was having heart problems. And all through that first year, he was in and out of the hospital. So there was more at stake than just having a very difficult actor.
You thought he might actually kill your showrunner.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, David was going to his knees in the parking lot. He was in serious trouble. And here we had this unlikely hit show that was just getting so many accolades. And at the center of it was this actor who was so fortunate to be in the position he was in, and he just couldn't deal with it. And I think he sold himself a bill of goods about this being, you know, a stepping stone.
Right, he was going to be a movie star.
To film stardom. Right. And of course, it ultimately didn't work out for him that way, and he came back to television.
Were you surprised he was able to sustain on the CSI that long? What do you think? Maybe he learned.
No, I wasn't. And the reason I wasn't is very simple. It was a single star vehicle.
Right. All he did was take off those glasses.
You know, I learned my lesson a million years ago because I watched and worked on shows with single stars, and they had you by the short hairs. What were you going to do? You couldn't fire them. And so over time, this horrible dynamic would take hold where the star of the show became the dominant power in the show and dictated everything. And I figured out very early that I was going to be a lot safer with an ensemble drama, because if somebody really turned out to be a jerk, you could sit them down.
Well, you had an encounter later with Gina Davis when you were brought in to try to salvage Commander-in-Chief.
Yeah, and there's nothing I could do.
I was interested in the biggest on-again, off-again relationship I think of your life, which is David Milch.
Yes.
This is a guy who has incredible demons, which haunt him to this day.
Yes.
Gambling, drugs at the time, I don't know now. He was like going off to Vegas at night and then coming back.
He was living in Las Vegas. You know, he'd fly in at 6:30 in the morning and he'd fly back out there, you know, at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, stay up all night gambling and come back the next morning. I don't know how he did it, but I never had any problem keeping David between the lines on Hill Street. On NYPD Blue, towards the end of his tenure, it got tough because his work habits became very erratic and he wouldn't deliver material in a timely fashion. That's why Jimmy Smits left the show. He just couldn't work that way. You know, and in the morning, David would come in and say to our production manager, well, how many pages do you need today? Six. And David would go into his office, and an hour later, he'd have six pages, and he'd walk them down to the set and read them out loud to everybody and act out everybody's parts. And I mean, it just was getting out of hand. And the work was suffering significantly. And we agreed, you know, in the seventh season that it was going to be his last, one way or the other. And I think when David left, understandably, he kind of thought that without him, the show wouldn't survive. We flourished for another 5 years.
Right. Nobody's indispensable.
But David, for all of that, is one of a small handful of the most gifted writers I've ever worked with.
So you figured, I'll suffer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was worth it.
Coming up after a short break, Stephen Bochco on why he was banned from the Fox executive dining room for years and how he got his table back. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
You were trying to control me. Nothing I could do or say. If you fall to pieces through the hard times, there wasn't much to you.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with television producer Stephen Bochco about his memoir, Truth is a Total Defense.
Bochco writes of an unprecedented 10-series deal he landed with ABC in 1987, following the success of Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law. Out of that deal came Doogie Howser, M.D., as well as the failed police musical, Cop Rock. Then in 1993, Bochco and David Milch gave ABC a signature hit, NYPD Blue. The show was another awards magnet, winning 20 Emmys and 2 Peabodys. For all 12 seasons of NYPD Blue, Dennis Franz played Detective Andy Sipowicz, a well-meaning but heavy-drinking cop willing to break the rules to catch a perp.
Now you are going to tell me what happened to that little girl.
I want a lawyer. You can't do this.
No, this is just us, Ken. There ain't going to be no lawyer, no court, no wrongful conviction, because you're going to take care of this right here.
After wrapping up his deal at ABC, Bochco went to CBS. Les Moonves, still running the company today, was then new in his job there.
I think we were the first overall deal that he made. And the first show that we made for him was this half-hour police comedy called Public Morals. And it was just not a good experience. It clearly wasn't for him, and it wasn't for me. But we got past that.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is you talk about the way that over time you came to realize that the broadcast world had become, I think you said, stultifying or...
Close enough.
Yeah.
Close enough.
Close enough. And in that context, your lack of compatibility with Les and the success of CBS, is that all part of a piece?
Actually, my time at CBS at the time, I certainly didn't equate it with the way the industry was beginning to change. I think it was a little bit before that time. For me, what actually made broadcast television unpleasant to work in was this vertical integration taking place.
Right. Every place got acquired by some place that was bigger, swallowed by a bigger fish.
Correct. And it threw the creative authority back into the hands of executives. And I had been working for 20 plus years in an environment that was refreshingly independent from a creative point of view. Once they agreed to let me do something, they left me alone. And if you want to use the word, I got spoiled by that. And as that pendulum began to shift back towards the way it was when I first got into the business, I was in a position where, A, I didn't need the money, and B, I didn't want the aggravation. Who needs that?
If you've had your wins, yeah, you can afford to
say,
I don't want to do it.
But,
I guess,
you know, where I've gotten to today is it's fine to speak up and it's fine to fight battles for creative freedom and all that stuff. But if you want to be in the business, then you have to accept the changes in the business because I don't see it going back.
But we do have cable streaming services.
Absolutely.
A variety
but
of choices.
For instance, we're redeveloping LA Law now, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it. But if you're redeveloping LA Law, which was a tremendous broadcast hit, then, you know, you have to be cognizant of who you're developing it for. And personally, I don't see LA Law as a cable show under any circumstance. I really do see it.
Well, it was an NBC show.
Yeah.
I assume it will again be.
I don't know if it'll be an NBC show. I don't know if it'll be anybody's show.
Right.
But we're developing it for 20th Century Fox, and they can take it wherever they want.
Okay.
Personally, if I were Bob Greenblatt.
At NBC?
Yeah. Assuming that it was a pilot that, you know, people thought was good, I wouldn't let it go anywhere but back to me because it was an iconic title for NBC in the 80s.
So you don't know yet, is the bot? You don't.
No, we're doing it now. But my point simply being that if you're going to do it with 100% commitment to the medium you're developing it for.
But it's different now, so how is it different if you're doing LA Law for now?
Well, the reason it's different, and it's the only reason that I'm enthusiastic about doing it, unlike redeveloping Hill Street Blues, which I would never do.
Just too special?
Well, for its time. It wouldn't be special in 2016. There's nothing I could do with that show that would approximate the cultural impact that it had, you know, in 1981.
That day, yeah.
But with LA Law, the stories that you tell today about the legal system didn't exist 30 years ago. In 1986, you couldn't have imagined, for instance, the Supreme Court of the United States essentially dictating who becomes the president of the United States. You couldn't imagine a legal case involving bathroom use by transgender individuals. So there are opportunities to illuminate legal proceedings today that are completely different from anything that existed then.
So you had
this deal at Fox, and you got into major litigation with them. Mm-hmm. And this was part of the corporatization and expansion of that world. They were starting FX. Mm-hmm. They wanted to use, I guess it was NYPD Blue.
Correct.
To launch FX. And you had no immediate objection. You didn't, you know, this is a sale into syndication. They tell you you can only get, I think, $400,000 per episode.
It started at $350,000 and they grudgingly bumped it up to four.
And you sort of were like, okay. And then you subsequently find that they are basically seem to be self-dealing, that they mm-hmm. that you could have sold this thing for much more. And ultimately, I think this was a long fight, right?
Yeah, it was over a little over 2 years.
A lot of people can't afford to fight that fight because it's so expensive.
Correct.
But you decided, I'm going to do it.
You know, I'm a stubborn old Jew, I guess.
And you got kicked out of the dining room, right?
I got banned from the commissary, correct.
For 2 years, you were banned.
Because we tried to serve, we did serve Rupert Murdoch
right.
in front of the commissary because none of his lawyers or anybody else would accept service on his behalf, you know, when we tried to subpoena
it, right?
him. So I left a pass for a process server. Little old lady, and, you know, she confronted Rupert coming in to have lunch with Peter Chernin. And she said, oh, are you Rupert Murdoch, you know? And he said, yes, I am. She said, bang, you're served. And Peter was so outraged, you know, that they banned me from the commissary.
So when you finally, after this fight, you demand what you said was your old table back.
Well, we were on the verge of settling the suit. And I said to our attorney, I want written into the settlement agreement that I get my table back in the commissary. And there was this long pause, and he said, oh, please, don't make me do that. He said, complicated settlements have unraveled for stuff like that. I said, well, tell him your client is crazy, and if I don't get my table, I'll see him in court. He called me back 15 minutes later and said, go to the commissary and find out your table number. In the 2 years that I'd not been in there, they'd completely remodeled it. And I looked around and I said, what's the number of that table? And they did. They put it into the settlement agreement.
This was right next to this, like close to Rupert Murdoch's normal table. So you would, so did you then go and sit there and smile at Rupert Murdoch?
You know, the truth is, in those days, he was almost never there. So I don't even remember.
Didn't turn into a problem.
But, you know, here's the thing about Rupert, who I have enormous respect for, actually. One of the advantages that a studio always has over talent, separate and apart from the financial resources, is that for them, it's never personal. For us as artists, it's always personal. And that always puts us at a disadvantage. I think if I had occasion to spend an evening in Rupert's company, if he remembered it at all, I don't think he would take it personally.
Stephen Bochco is a writer, producer, showrunner, co-creator of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, NYPD Blue. His book, Truth is a Total Defense, is out now. You can get it on Amazon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.